Listen up, if you liked the Dark Enlightenment series that I took you down, you're going to have to listen to today's episode. I got a very special guest, Courtney Taylor, and she's been digging into this stuff way deep. And today we're going to catch up with her life story, which is fascinating. And you're going to hear about her background and how she got Red Pill awakened and her research into the Dark Enlightenment. We're going to talk about the technocracy movement, the planned AI government, Hegelian left and right dialectic, various political ideologies. And she goes deep into the world of the tech oligarchs, and you're going to hear about Game B and all kinds of stuff. She talks because she's writing a book. Be on the lookout for that. And I'm going to put links in the show notes where you can catch up with her podcast and her social medias and a couple of videos that we referenced during the interview. One is about the Hegelian dialectic, and the other is about a technocracy roundtable video. So check out her social medias, her podcast, and her videos while you're listening. And also, if you're watching the video version of the show, which, as you know, I've got the Tier 2 supporters, they get the ad-free video on unlisted private links. But I'm putting free feed videos out on my Spotify, Rumble, and new, third YouTube channel. We had some internet connections, and there's some lag issues that I thought I could fix it post-production, and I could not, turns out. So the audio should be fine, but the video version, you might see some parts where the lips don't match what's being said. My apologies, okay? So here you go. Check out all of her links while you're listening to the show, and I will catch you on the other side. All right, today's guest is a person that I had the privilege to meet only recently when we were doing a show with Donut together. She's the host of the Courtney Turner podcast, where she's been exploring some super deep topics that I know I'm interested in. I know all my listeners are going to enjoy. It's a blend of philosophy, from my perspective, a blend of philosophy, technology, and how it's shaping our world today. And when we were on Donut Show, she was dropping mad knowledge on the Dark Enlightenment, and I just had to get her on here to share her perspective. So welcome to the Occult Symbolism and Pop Culture Podcast, Miss Courtney Turner.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
It's
an honor.
Of course. Yeah, this is great. You know, it's interesting to me when I find, because I have this weird, when I first started all of this sort of conspiracy realm stuff, I was really deep into who the figures were of everything. And over time, I find myself sort of isolating into my own world of research, as I'm sure you know how this goes. So when I did the show with Donut, I didn't know who you were, like, to be honest. And that's fine, because I don't know who a lot of the sort of the voices are in the movement here, right?
True.
And I was listening when we were doing Donut, and I was like, oh man, like she knows some stuff, because like you had a background in philosophy and stuff. And what I wanted to do first, what I think would be the best, mm-hmm, for me and the audience, is I would love for you to share your journey into this sort of conspiracy theory realm, because I'm always interested in how people end up over here, you know. From what I do know, reading through your information in your bio and on your website, I've seen a lot of parallels and common interests that I've had that got me into this, specifically maintaining a physical and mental health and things like this. So I'm curious to hear your perspective. Would you mind kind of briefly going through, you know, your life's journey of how you got here, if you don't mind?
Yeah, sure. It was definitely somewhat unusual. I make the joke that it took me a very long time to find the train station. Then I found the high-speed rail, and I've been like scrambling to catch up. And what I mean by that is I woke up very late. Like 2020 was kind of my wake-up moment. And I did have people along the way who planted a lot of seeds. I'm very grateful for them. And this is why I tell people, don't get discouraged if you're trying to share information, you feel like it's falling on deaf ears, because you just never know when those seeds that you planted are, you know, when there's going to be fertile soil for it to sprout. You just don't know. So, and that was the case for me. And, you know, everybody has their reasons why they're ready to listen to something or why they reject the information at that time. And for me, it was, it was very personal. My father was, really what I wouldn't have known at the time, but he was very much a neocon. And it felt like politics is one of the only things we would really talk about. So I couldn't like hear some of these things that people were telling me, because my father would tell me, you know, don't listen to them. They're crazy conspiracy theorists. Like, you can't, you know, you have to ignore that. That's just nonsense. And I really felt like I didn't want to jeopardize the relationship with my father at that time. And so I kind of just, you know, pushed it down, ignored it. And then 2020 hit. And of course, I lived in Santa Monica, California, where everything shut down. It was, you know, it was quite tyrannical. And for those who are not familiar with my story, my birth story, I was born with a kind of an unusual set of circumstances. My mom was sick during the first trimester of pregnancy, and I was rendered with all sorts of physical complications. So I'm blind in one eye. I actually had cataract surgery when I was only 3 months old. It was not what it is today, and they left debris. They had to go back and do like a retinal cleanup and all sorts of subsequent kinds of surgery. So I'm actually blind in that eye. And then I'm hearing impaired bilaterally. I didn't get hearing until I was almost 6 years old, though. I learned how to speak by reading lips. My first accent was actually British, because we had my baby nurse was from the British Islands. So,
Wow.
Yeah, they move their mouth so differently. And I learned by, you know, mimicking. So I was mimicking the very closed mouth kind of speech. And that makes the different sound. That's where you get the dialect. So,
Fascinating. Okay.
So I had heart surgery when I was a year old. I was born with hypotonic limbs, fine graphic motor impairment, stunted growth. They basically told my mom the best she could hope for me was to find a very nice institution for me to spend my life, because I was going to be, you know, completely autistic, retarded, blind, deaf. I don't mean that to be, you know, politically incorrect. Like, you know, and so fortunately they were wrong. I'm very grateful for that. And fortunately, you know, we were able to find ways for me to cope and overcome some of these challenges. However, when 2020 hit and I'm living in Santa Monica, California, and everybody's got their face covered, I didn't realize how much I still depend on nonverbal communication for clarity of speech, until all the coping mechanisms I spent my life developing were then stripped from me. And right. So I was in the entertainment industry. I was an actress. I was a film producer. I grew up right outside New York City, and then I lived in LA, Santa Monica. So I was used to being in a sea of leftists, and I was very used to kind of downplaying or, you know, staying out of political discourse, because it was, my views were typically not well received. So being someone who doesn't love to seek confrontation and doesn't love being fired or blacklisted just for, you know, speaking my mind, I usually opted out of those discussions. But when 2020 came around, I found myself just being, I can't prove it, but I'm like 99.999 repeating infinitely sure that I was fired from both of the gyms I was working at the time for political reasons. And, you know, there was a sequence of events in both gyms that kind of lead me to believe that that's what happened. So I was also an aerial acrobatic performer, and I would speak mostly on movement as a metaphor for life. And I would talk about like the philosophical components of physical movement, where you're teaching people how to use their physical training as a teacher to help them overcome adversity in other areas of their life. And I would do the aerial performances mostly just to prove to people what was possible when nobody thought it was, and because it's really fun. But of course, when everything was shut down and you can't conjure in groups of more than whatever arbitrary number, obviously those events were shut down. So I found myself unemployed with lots of time on my hands, and I thought it would be a great opportunity to write. And I found myself so incredibly anxious and depressed because I couldn't talk to people because everybody's face was covered and I couldn't understand them. So I was really, really depressed and anxious, which I don't think I was alone in that, but I think it was exacerbated because of my unique circumstances. And so I found a beautiful white screen staring back at me at the end of 10 hours that day, and realized that I probably couldn't force this creative process, and my grand visions of writing my manifesto were probably not going to happen at that time. So I ordered 11 books and I started reading a lot. But then, of course, I wanted to talk to people about all the things I was reading, and I chewed my mom's ear off for as long as she would allow me, and on the phone. And then she would be very polite, but it was getting to be a bit much. So I started sharing some of my thoughts on social media, and I really didn't think they were controversial at all. But I've learned that, you know, if you post a picture of an orange on social media, you will get like 20,000 people will tell you, no, that's an apple. So that's just how this works. So I found that a little bit frustrating. And I had some people reach out to me saying, you should start a podcast. And I was so naive. I had not listened to podcasts. I knew nothing about podcasts. And some people who had heard my birth story said, you need to be on Rogan. And I said, well, what's a Rogan? Why do I need to be on it? And this is how little I knew about podcasts. I know who Joe Rogan is, for the record now. But you know, but I mean, I was just not aware, totally clueless. But I started listening to podcasts. And they became kind of my friends. It was entertaining me. I could hear them and felt like I was having, I guess the way people used to feel when they would watch TV weekly, you know, and the celebrities are in their living room, they feel like those are their friends. And that's kind of sadly what became my, first few months of 2020. And then I started to think about it. And the idea of doing a podcast terrified me. However, I realized that it would be a way to have naked face conversations. And that might save my life. Even if it was over a digital interface, if I could see somebody's face and have meaningful conversations, that would be so fulfilling and rewarding for me. So I made a commitment for 6 months that I was going to record conversations. If I could be so blessed to do them in person, great. But, you know, even if it was over some sort of a digital interface, that we would do that. And I told my guests that I might not air them, that this was really for me. I just want to be able to talk to people and see their face. And I really enjoyed it. They really enjoyed it. And so I aired my first one in January of 2021, sorry. And they, in the beginning, you know, really started it coming from a very political and very, in the health freedom kind of space. And I remember in the beginning, I kept saying, you know, if we could just get the right people in office and we could fix this whole mess. And I kept saying that I felt like the Republicans were behaving as controlled opposition for the left. A few months, but I think it was really a few weeks into this process of, no, they were created to be controlled opposition. That's kind of how this thing works. And I started diving pretty deep down the rabbit hole. And the first, I would say my big, like, major kind of veil lifting was there was a friend of mine. I don't know why in 2020, everybody had some sort of major crises at midnight. It was just like midnight. It was the most pressing time for me to dive into something. And then, of course, I was not going to be able to sleep. But I had a friend who sent me a video of Dr. John Coleman, and it was his Committee of 300 video, which is actually surprisingly still on YouTube. So you can find that still. And he said, have you ever heard of him? Have you ever watched this? And I said, no. And he said, okay, you have to watch this and then call me. So I did. And of course, we were on the phone until 5 a.m. And I started looking through all of his books. And I found one of them was retailing on Amazon for almost $4,000. Whoa, what don't they want us to know? Now you can get it for $25. I don't know what they've changed or, you know, what has transpired in that time. But I obviously was not spending $4,000 I didn't have on this book, but I was able to find it, the PDF online. And to my knowledge, he's no longer with us. So I don't feel bad about, you know, taking the author's work for free. But I read it 3 times in a week. And it was Dr. John Coleman's book on Tavistock, the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations. And because my academic background had been mostly seeped in the field of psychology and philosophy, there were 285-page theses on dream analysis when I was in high school. They were essentially dissertations. Like, I did a field work, I presented before a panel mostly of neuroscientists. And so I had a very strong background in psychology. Philosophy I did independent studies on in high school, and then I majored in college. And so, and then I was in the film industry, and Tavistock was kind of, this book was exposing how all three of those fields converged for the purposes of social engineering, whether intentionally or whether it was utilized that way. People may dispute. I certainly have lots of thoughts on that, but it certainly they were very instrumental in creating tools that were used for social engineering purposes. So it really captured my interest because those were things I had been so immersed in for most of my life. So, and then that was when I could no longer be quite as naive.
Do you think that the philosophy and dream analysis and those things you had learned in college were at odds with what you had read from Dr. John Coleman, or did it kind of just say the same stuff from a different angle? Like, what do you think's going on there?
Oh, completely at odds. So I had written my college thesis on existential authenticity. I had done, my high school, basically dissertations on dream analysis. So I was very enamored with these figures. And I was, all of my professors and teachers had presented them, as the heroes of history. And so it was the only things I had a mini kind of awakening in around 2011, 2012. I had a friend who had, was writing a book at the time on the Frankfurt School. And I was very familiar with the Frankfurt School as a philosophy major, but all the things he was talking about were coming from a very different perspective than what my professors were espousing. However, when I was in college, I was actually arguing with my professors all the time. In fact, I had so many arguments with my thesis advisor that I would go to the head of the department of philosophy. We didn't agree at all, but at least he would allow me to have true intellectual discourse. Like, we could really hash out the ideas. Whereas my thesis advisor was just obsessed with Michel Foucault. And, he just wouldn't tolerate any kind of dissonance at all. So, but because I had these conversations with my friend who was writing this book on the Frankfurt School, it really opened my eyes to how they were utilizing tactics to infiltrate through culture in ways that I really hadn't thought about, or I don't think I was really, I knew intuitively, but my professors were arguing so vehemently against me.
Are there any example? I mean, I know this is like a massive can of worms to open up, and I want to talk Dark Enlightenment with you, but
yeah,
you're aware of Jay Dyer. I saw that he on your Twitter bio, you had a link to a conference you were throwing in Nashville, yeah. I believe.
Jay and Jamie, I consider them great friends. Jay and okay. I have the same birthday.
What's that?
Jay and I have the same birthday.
He's my birthday. Okay.
He's like a couple of years younger, but yeah, same birthday.
Yeah, because like Jay gets into a lot of this. My research and interests are trying to understand these things, and then trying to talk about pop culture and the occult, mm-hmm. and like how all of these things kind of go together in various ways. But some of it gets a little too heady for me, right? And I'm trying to understand, because I know, Jay would talk about Tavistock things as well. And I'm reading this book. I'm trying to see if I can see the title from here, but it's covered up. Anyway, I'm reading this book about how the CIA was part of this sort of culture creation thing. And it's a real academic type book. So it's really painful to read. And I'm trying to hack my way through this thing. But do you have any examples because if I'm hearing you correctly, you're kind of supporting the theory that all of these, elites are using methods of, psychology or philosophy to what sort of steer us down a path of total control, or what's kind of an example of what you think this looks like?
Well, there's so many, but I recently wrote an article. I wrote three, actually, on this term, which I'm not a huge fan of the label itself, but the underpinnings of it I can support. And I wrote this article on the term that's been floating around called the woke right. But
I've heard that. Yeah.
Right. So, and it's definitely tied into the Dark Enlightenment. So we'll get there. But really, what I was trying, and I got some flack for not being. The way I interpreted it, they didn't necessarily use this term, but not being gossipy enough. Like, I didn't talk about, people want things that are salacious, right? They want to hear all the figures, like, oh, who are all the names? And they want to point the fingers, and they want like specific examples so they can discuss the gossip without discussing the architecture, the operating system, and the philosophical presuppositions that underline what's actually happening. And I, you know, for me, I'm not really interested in all that stuff. I think I'd probably be a lot more appealing to a lot of people if I were. But to me, it's really about the tactics, because I want, it's not for me to tell you what to think. I want you to be able to recognize the tactics and then use your own discernment. Because I think that critical thinking has been, you know, intentionally eradicated from our education. And so, but in this, one of the things I wrote about was how, like, for example, Christopher Rufo has been talking about how Antonio Gramsci should be utilized for the right, political right, that they should use his tactics. He's also, you know, indicated that people like Saul Alinsky, who were, you know, mentors to people like Obama, and Hillary Clinton, and he wrote The Rules for Radicals, which he actually dedicated to Lucifer, the original radical who had his own kingdom. Yes, these are the kind of figures. And then, of course, you know, people like the Frankfurt School, the cultural Marxists. And so in these series of articles, what I talk about are what were these tactics so that people like Antonio Gramsci were using. So Antonio Gramsci, most of his work actually came out of when he was in prison, the prison notebooks. But there's a lot more that you can get. I recommend people reading his grandson's memoirs. I think they're quite revealing.
I've never heard of any of these names.
Oh, okay.
Okay. This is fascinating. Okay, go ahead.
Lenin famously, you know, was very baffled by the fact that after the Bolshevik Revolution, it didn't spread throughout the West like Karl Marx had promised, right? He promised that you were going to have this, you know, revolution that was going to spread all over. And Lenin didn't understand. He was so, you know, flummoxed, like, what's going on? And so he had called a meeting. There were several meetings, but, you know, the Lenin Marxist Institute in Moscow was one of the famous meetings. And he had many meetings with Gramsci, and he had asked, and Gramsci had said, I think the problem is you're treating this as an economic problem and you're seeking an economic revolution. However, as long as people are entrenched in their cultural belief systems, like the culture of capitalism, for instance, you're never going to have an economic revolution. This is a cultural problem. And so this is where he actually didn't coin the term long march through the institutions. It was something Roy, I have it in my article, I'm just drawing a blank on his name. But it was, that was the concept that there were these five pillars of society and that you need to infiltrate them in order to create a long march, a cultural revolution that was gradual and incremental, kind of like the Fabian socialist style, right? This is why the Fabians had their mascot as the tortoise, because slow, steady incrementalism. Their coat of arms is actually the wolf in sheep's clothing, which I think is a nod to the Hegelian dialectic, which represents their tactics. I have a Substack article on the Fabian tactics of propaganda. People are interested in diving into that. And they're actually a splinter group of the Fellowship of the New Life, which is a theosophical organization inspired by the Transcendentalist movement. But yeah, whole nother can of worms there. Yeah. But that was his recommendation, was that you have to go through the pillars of society, like religion, like law, like education, like entertainment, media. You know, these kinds of pillars that are anchoring society. And if you could infiltrate those institutions, the academic institutions were another one, then you could have this slow, gradual kind of subversion. And this is where, you know, we get the concepts of things like color revolution. Mao was a huge example of this. And there's a lot of evidence that Mao was actually trained by, British affiliates through Skull and Bones. Anthony Sutton writes about this. There are a few others who have written pretty extensively on it as well. But he was trained through Yale in China, is the outfit. So he was actually a Yalie. And so I don't think it was a purely Chinese concept. There's a lot of overlap with this cultural Marxist kind of tactics.
You know, there's this isn't my forte, isn't like politics or some of the things you're talking about right now, like the architecture of this control system.
Yeah.
And for a variety of reasons. And it's not my forte. So I don't know what to think of it all. And I had Jay on, and I said, because I'm not a conservative guy. I'm moderate. I've got a hefty amount of sort of right wing values, and then I've got probably more values that are leftist. But overall, I'm a pretty moderate guy. I'm reasonable. I think there's extremists on both sides that are like so loud and it's obscene. And I think most people are pretty moderate. But what I asked Jay is because what I know of the history of like the FBI, COINTELPRO, the CIA, it seemed like the intelligence agencies had a real beef with communism. And I'm not saying that's not justified. Like, I'm not a communist guy. I for capitalism, for all the evils involved in it, I think is overall kind of the, probably the best thing we got going. But what I don't understand is how, as a conspiracy guy who sits here and says, oh my God, the FBI was taking out subversives and communists, and then they had all this propaganda like the Mockingbird that they were telling us how bad communism was and lying to us about how great capitalism is, and we had all these false flag wars like in Vietnam, the Gulf of Tonkin, for, you know, just to take down communism, like it's over and over and over and over. And I like, so I mean, philosophically debating, I feel like, wouldn't it be that if the enemy trying to deceive us is saying, no, communism's bad, capitalism's great, shouldn't that make us think, well, maybe communism isn't bad, maybe the control system is capitalism? And I'm not advocating for that. I'm just saying, like, wouldn't that, that's where my brain goes when I start looking into all of these things that you're talking about, like the color revolutions and things. Tell me why I'm wrong in that, please. Jay explained it to me in a way, and I was like, okay, that kind of makes sense, but I'm still hung up around the axles about this.
Fair enough. And it's a valid question. And you're teetering on the edge of something that is there, where there's a lot of validity. I'm in the process of, and I've got a sneak preview up, a bulk of it is already up on my Substack, but I'm writing a book on Hegelian dialectics, and I call it Hegel's Dialectic, A Gnostic Jacob's Ladder, and A Machinery of Control. So, you know, and I do think, just to back up a little bit, when you said you're coming more from more of a conspiracy occult kind of perspective, I think they're all very interwoven. And I think, so the joke I make, and it's not politically correct, so I forgive me if I offend anybody, but the joke I make is that, because I see that the occult works through the left and right, but it's more like marketing kind of tactics, not to say that there aren't philosophical underpinnings for, you know, communism or capitalism or conservatism. There are. But in today's society, mostly they become target audiences for marketing purposes. And what I see is they kind of have figured out that, and that these same occult groups are working through the left and the right. And they've kind of figured out that, you know, some people have mommy issues and some people have daddy issues. But either way,
Okay.
Yeah, right. Some have both, you know.
Just joking, mom.
Right. Yeah. But either way, they're going to have, you know, the blue comfort blankie or the pink comfort blankie, okay, and they'll pacify you.
Okay.
And that's kind of how they operate. So I see, when you're talking about like capitalism versus communism, people like, who I call, you know, they call themselves the futurists. And I always make the other joke that, you know, it's really easy to predict the future when you plan it. So, but the futurists like Brzezinski and Kissinger, for instance, would talk about this clash between East and West philosophies, right? Like capitalism and fascism, or capitalism and communism, or communism and fascism, and how they would be pitted against each other. And they didn't necessarily use the term dialectical, but for dialectical purposes, so that they, you know, you could create the dialectical churn. I see it as a spiral. And Hegel used kind of that, you know, descriptor. And it becomes a spiral that is pointing towards the omega point, which they were saying would be the emergence of the technocracy. And this gets to why I'm pointing that I think that the Dark Enlightenment and the Game B are left versus right, you know, in terms of marketing umbrella dialectics, in order to usher in the noosphere concept, which will lead towards the technological singularity. And I do think this is all tied to occult belief systems. It all ends up being theological, spiritual, because it's about their worldview. And I call it the technological immunization of the eschaton. So and that's a concept you're familiar with, and I'm sure your audience is as well. But that's very much what I see them doing, because they're, I don't know if this, it's that they don't believe that there is a heaven, or they just don't think they're going there. but they want to create heaven here on earth. For me, it looks a little more like a hellscape or a dystopia. I'm not so sure it's going to be heaven. But in order to bring this heaven on earth, it has to be synthetic, right? Because they can't create anything new. So it's a, you know, it's an inversion of everything, and it is synthetic. It's not organic, because it's not, you know, it's not from the creator. So
are you a spiritual person? Do you follow a certain religion of any kind?
I don't necessarily follow a specific religion. I grew up, you know, kind of without any religion. My family's Jewish, which I know is not very popular these days. But they were not religious. So I didn't grow up with any religion. And my husband's Christian. And so we've been starting to read the Bible. And it's just, you know, I never expected that I'd find myself like in this theological space. But when I started doing all of this of, you know, when I was looking at the political landscape, it led me to the philosophical underpinnings, which I had a background in, but also led me to, you know, the psychological kind of profiling of the personalities and the orchestration of power and the operations of power, right? And when you start going far enough down the rabbit hole of psychology, you just get into the esoteric, the occult. That's who created it. Wow. And when you get into the power structure of the oligarchs, of the architects of globalism, it's all theosophy. So
does looking at all of this stuff, because I'm not going to make this about me, but like, I was raised in a sort of non-denominational church with my mother took me, I went like 3 times a week, and my father, he didn't like the church. So he identified as a Christian. He would read the Bible often. I'd see him reading his Bible often, but he was very much not your textbook sort of Christian. Like, he was a big prison guard with tattoos and got into all kinds of trouble sometimes. And but when I turned 16, my mom stopped making me go to church. I was like, oh, thank God that's over. And I had doubts about it. And when I was, how old was I? 21. Me and my wife, my girlfriend decided to get married. And I got baptized Greek Orthodox, and I really loved the Orthodox Church. I was really hardcore about it for about 10, 15 years. And then I kind of chilled out a little bit, and I haven't really gone in like 5 years for no particular reason. It's not like I'm like, oh, I'm an atheist now because I hate God. Like, it's not like that at all. I mean, I say prayers, and I believe in all the same tenets of Orthodoxy. Absolutely. I just, Orthodoxy has a high demand for the practice. It's pretty intense if you want to go the full experience. And I did it for many, many years. I just kind of burned out a little bit. And anyway, my point being that it's interesting to me, because as I dive deeper into the occult and your very good description of the architecture of the system and the tactics they use, I always end up researching how they are interested in the occult and Gnosticism and things like that, and the simulation world. It further deepens me into my Christian faith background. I'm not saying it makes me a better Christian. That's for sure. I got my own problems, but the more I look at it, the more I find myself being like, oh man, Christianity must be real. Like, they have such a beef with it. Like, Aleister Crowley and Jack Parsons, like they wouldn't stop talking about it. It was like their version of their Trump derangement syndrome. Like, it's just lived in their head constantly. And, yep. I just wonder how that fits when you research all this stuff, because from what I guess you didn't really, prior to 2020, I'm guessing you didn't really read into the occult much.
No, I mean, yeah, no. And I mean, I was a like yoga teacher, and I taught like partner acrobatics, and all of them were into like love and light. I mean, it was all new age
stuff. And I like a lot of that. That's where my problem lies, is I like a lot of that new age psychobabble stuff, because it makes me feel good. And ultimately, I can't deny it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, who can argue with love and light? I mean, except when you read the World Invocation Day prayer, this always creeps me out. I always talk about it because it creeps me out so much. But at the end of it, it says to seal the door where evil dwells. I'm like, whoa, which side are we locking the door? Like, they don't specify.
Yeah, that is creepy.
So yeah, no, for me, I mean, it definitely, I'm definitely not an atheist. There's no way you could be reading all of this. I shouldn't speak for others, but there's no way I could be after reading all this stuff. There's just no way. They are very, adamantly opposed to any monotheistic religion. So it's really all the Abrahamic faiths, but particularly traditional Judaism and Christianity. Madame Blavatsky talks about it all the time. She always says how she's diametrically opposed to Christianity and traditional Judaism. Same with Alice Bailey. Alice Bailey actually talks about, her whole plan in the externalization of the hierarchy. And, one of this in the section 4 of the externalization of the hierarchy, where she starts to map out this plan, she talks about how the Jews have to be eradicated. That is part of the plan, because otherwise they can't achieve the rest of their goals in creating the syncretic religion.
When you say the syncretic religion, you're comparing that to the technological singularity, the noosphere, Omega point, all those things? Or
I think it underpins it. So we have, and this is where when we do get to like the Dark Enlightenment, I think it's just the right-hand path of these more theosophical spiritualist belief systems that are but both of them are steering us towards the singularity. They're just doing it in different flavors. So, it's like you can go to an ice cream shop and it's filled with chemicals and poison, but they'll give you, whatever flavor you prefer. So you might prefer the strawberry, the vanilla. So, either way, you're going to get your preferred flavor of poison. And I always use because they always do this paltering where they, mix the truths in. And so I use the analogy of the ice cream that's, not so good for you, but you really want it. And it's an ice cream cone, but then they pour on the sprinkles and the sprinkles are the truth. And so you keep licking the sprinkles. And you're like, oh, it must be true. This is good for me. And before you know it, you've eaten the whole hook gripping lie. And that is kind of how these operations work. And it's because they're masters of deception. I talk about the triple D's, that's their trinity that they worship. I guess you could call them the Luciferians, the Satanists, whatever occult flavor it is. But it is, in Christianity, there's a trinity. And then their trinity is the triple D's. It's they're masters of deception. So they deceive, they distort in order to manipulate the truths to get you to convince you of their lies. And then there's the division. And this is why I've written this. I'm writing this book on the Hegelian dialectic, because it really is, I think, such a tool for them. And it's an operating system and they use it to divide and conquer. Yep.
And you had a video on your Rumble account about the Hegelian left-right building the technocracy. Is this part of your book's topic and research? And does this all fit into the Dark Enlightenment stuff?
Yeah. So, yes, I had in my book, I'm really trying to lay out, I go through the ancient mystery cults and how their obsession with the unity of opposites for purposes of transcendence. It's like they don't see the good and evil has to be integrated in order to achieve transcendence. So it's not separate. It's an integration. You see this theme throughout most of these ancient mystery cults. And so I lay out a lot of them. I'm sure I've missed some, but they all have very similar. I use little g as an umbrella term for all the Gnostic belief systems. People will argue with me and they'll say, well, the Hermeticists were arguing with the Gnostics in the first century. I understand that. I know the history, but they still have shared underlying worldviews and they still have shared, really, I would call it the architecture, the operating system that drives their practices, their rituals, and their belief systems. So I use little g Gnosticism as the umbrella that paved the way for Hegel. And Hegel was immersed in these occult circles. It was actually Fichte who interpreted Kant's dialectic, which Hegel rejected, as being thesis, antithesis, synthesis. And this is what has become the popular, trilectic that people parrot. And it was actually, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name properly, but it's Schallibaus who actually coined that term, the triad. But it was Fichte's interpretation of Kant. And that was never said by Hegel at all. Hegel talked about the abstract, negative, and concrete. But he was very much inspired by people like Fichte, and Fichte was directly immersed in these occult circles of, the Illuminati, people like Goethe. They were all kind of in these Illuminati occult circles. He was definitely tied in. I think that had a huge influence on his belief system. And he himself, Hegel, who was actually very influential on the Dark Enlightenment, but Hegel himself talks about how my whole thesis is that it is a Aesopian language, that it's written for the initiated to interpret the esoteric messages, and then he has an exoteric veneer. And the exoteric veneer, he's trying to present it as being a very rational philosophy, very intellectual and academic. But he himself, and of course this is in German, but I'm telling you the translation as I understand it and as I've read it. But he says that, it's about the spirit of Geist, right? Geist is that the world spirit is progressing towards the rational absolute. However, when you read him, the rational absolute sounds intellectual and academic and logical, right? Mechanistic. But when you read him, he himself says that rational is speculative. And then he says speculative is no different than mystical. So he is telling you that this is a mystical belief system, that is what he is teaching you. And these are esoteric writings. And so in my book, I lay that out. And then I talk about some more current kind of examples to bring and why it's relevant today and how social engineers use it to divide and conquer.
Do you have any good examples that off the top of your head you could spit at us here?
The example in my video is the Dark Enlightenment versus Game B.
I don't know what Game B is.
I can tell you, but I can also give you a more like simple kind of example. I mean, people could just think about the left and the right, right? Politically, left and right, they're often used to pit against each other. We always hear about the pendulum's going to swing. What happens when the pendulum swings? They move the Overton window. A great example, I talk about the medical freedom movement. So if you notice in the medical freedom movement, we had all these people who were traditionally not in favor of certain things being put into their bodies. And historically, a lot of those people came from the left politically.
Right.
They were on the political left, right? They were the crunchy moms and they were anti-establishment and they were holistic and they identified as left-leaning. And suddenly they got slapped with a right-wing banner. They were either conservatives or Republicans or libertarians. And a lot of them actually came out and said, we're kind of confused, our views politically haven't changed, but I guess I'm right wing now, now I have to vote right wing or whatever it was. But that's how they shifted the Overton window. I have a theory that a lot of this was actually done. Speaking of the occult groups, I actually think a lot of this was done through the Knights of Malta, who were the originally the Knights of Hospitalier. And even today, the Knights of Malta, their exoteric messaging is that they do medical charity. And I'm sure they do some. If you know the history of the Knights of Malta, they're kind of like the left of the left-hand path of the Knights of the Templar, who tend to be the more militaristic order. The mommy and daddy issues, right? The right wing tend to be the more patriarchal, more authoritarian, disciplinarian. The left tend to be the divine mother leading with more emotionality, more spiritual in belief system, or at least what they lead with. And so But I think that they were instrumental in infiltrating and using that movement to shift the Overton window. And another great example, which also does lead us towards the Dark Enlightenment, is that we had a year ago, you had people on the right who would never have dreamed of buying an electric vehicle, right? Because the whole climate crisis is a scam, and this is all, Al Gore nonsense, and this is just for left-wing idiots. I'm not saying that, but that's how they think, or that's the kind of what we hear. And, but now, because Elon Musk is a part of the Trump administration, you have all these people who would never have dreamed of buying an electric vehicle running out to buy Teslas.
Right.
Right.
That is a great example. And that's, it's funny to me because I never really had an interest. Like I don't know that I buy into every component of the climate change stuff. Mm-hmm. But like my college background is science. So I lean towards it and I'm like, I kind of think this could be happening. Like we should take care of the planet. But then I see the people involved in it. And I'm like, yeah, but I don't really trust a lot of the people, and I think they want to make this a control system in the end and monitor our usage. And this is going to be a way for the elites to do what they want to do and fly in private jets. And the poors can all just kind of suffer and you don't get to go see anything. And it's interesting because I don't remember what year, around maybe 2018, Michael Moore of all people made a documentary about how the renewables movement was really not that healthy for the planet, for lack of a better term, because they got to get the lithium and they got to dig out the batteries, and then there's all this carbon footprint that they pretend doesn't exist, but and then you got to make the electricity, and even back then I was like, oh well, I'm not getting an electric car. And then recently a buddy of mine, he sold his Cybertruck, and he told me, because he's also part of I'm part of the sort of granola mom thing. Like I've been a granola mom for many, many years, and so is he. In fact, he was the first one that many years ago laid it on me, the idea of how he was very anti, stabby of the thing that we're talking about. Yeah. And he was telling me he sold a Cybertruck because of he's like, well, yeah, like all these EMF waves come off the batteries and the motors, and you're just sitting on top of all these EMF waves. And I was like, well, that makes, I'm an electrical engineer by through schooling, but that makes all the sense in the world. I never even thought about that. So I'm anti-electric car for that reason, but I know what you mean, because all these sort of left right shifts have happened, and it's frustrating because I do think there is some kind of Hegelian thing going on there, because it does seem very psyop-y, and it's just frustrating that people can't be a little more independent minded about things and not all of a sudden have to sort of let me segue, because I know we're running out of time, because I want to segue into Dark Enlightenment. And part of the fears that I have about the Dark Enlightenment, and I want to hear your take on the Dark Enlightenment. But my fear is how some people are scared of a communist dictator. I'm scared of an authoritarian dictator as well. And I feel like that's where the Dark Enlightenment takes us, is to the CEO king there, this neo-cameralism idea. And it's shocking to me to see so many people who I would consider, conservatives, obviously, like Republicans that vote Republican, who are very much like small government. They seem like they're very anti-authoritarian in the sense that they don't want the government interfering with their lives at all. And right. I actually, that's the part of me that's like, yeah, I'm with that. I get that. Right. But now they're sort of rooting on for this sort of ruling with an iron fist element that's very Dark Enlightenment. And I'm like, I don't know where this goes, but it's kind of terrifying to me. What do you think? Where do you want to take that part of the conversation?
It's terrifying to me too. I don't think it goes anywhere good. I'm not in favor of tyranny. I don't care what flavor of tyranny it is. I do not want totalitarianism of any kind. But this is what I will say, is that the people who are concerned about fascists versus the communists, just wait till the technocracy comes. That is going to be a tyranny that I don't think people can even fathom. They can't comprehend what that kind of tyranny looks like.
And why do you think that? How does that look to you? Is that a movie you've seen, or what's something?
I like a lot of movies. I like it. Where do we start? I don't know. The most recent one that I saw was Mickey 17, where he just keeps dying and keeps getting brought back to life. And that was, yeah. But yeah, there's so many movies that I feel like have been operational preparation of the environment. That would be the militaristic term for what they're doing, but predictive programming is more colloquially used. But yeah, I think that they're, so when I say the technocracy, obviously this is not a new concept. It's almost a century ago, Howard Scott was the leader of Technocracy Inc. And, you know, Technocracy Inc. was out of Columbia University. They were these, you know, very intellectual group and trying to come up with some sort of problem solving to, you know, the economic crash, you know, in the 20s and the, you know, the Depression era. And they were trying to, they come up with some sort of solution. And this solution just happens to look a lot like, you know, scientific dictatorship that Bertrand Russell lays out.
That's a Bertrand Russell thing?
Yeah, I mean, okay. That's exactly what technocracy is. It's a rule by the elites, but they wanted it to be ruled by the experts, right? It's ruled by the scientific without any kind of human input. It's just this very mechanistic kind of control. The thing is that back then, and of course, Elon Musk's grandfather was head of Technocracy Inc. in Canada from 1936 to 1943. And yes, his grandfather, Josh Heidelman, did pass away while Elon was very young, but he was very familiar with his grandfather's ideas and very immersed in them, very much a proponent of them. And he keeps talking about how he's going to implement this technocracy up on Mars. But I think that, you know, he's not instituting technocracy on Mars. What he's doing is creating technocracy here in the United States as part of the Trump administration. He's laying all of the foundation for that. And when you look at what it does, back then, I think it was scary enough just as an idea back then. But now you have the technology to really bring this to fruition. And if people think that government is scary with humans who want power, what happens when you have humans who are coding the smart contracts and, you know, the AI government, which is going to supplant all human governments? And they've talked about this. The AI World Society talks about it. Elon Musk talks about it. The Dark Enlightenment talks about it. Each state right now already has a digital government. ChatGPT has a government portal. And you have to be a government official to use it. And there's summits all over or in each state where they have these digital governance summits. And so they're already laying the groundwork for this. And, you know, people are very excited about Doge, where I'm all for efficiency. I'm all for transparency. I'm all for eradicating this, ridiculous bloated spending. That's great. Please, more of that. However, this whole concept that comes straight out of the Dark Enlightenment called RAGE, retirement of all government employees, is really what they're laying the groundwork for. That's what they're preparing so that they can have it replaced with AI. And if you think, a Project Argyle trained IRS official is scary, what happens when it's a robot who has no feelings and has just been programmed to execute? And Elon says that by 2040, you know, we're going to have more robots than humans. And it is this idea. So I think it's way scarier because you're not dealing with humans who have emotions and I have seen no evidence of any kind of technology having sentience. I know they're very invested in us believing that, because if we get enough people to believe that there is consciousness or sentience from a machine, I think the effect will be very similar to as if it actually did have sentience. But I see no evidence. You know, no matter how many times Yuval Noah Harari tells us that he's going to upload our consciousness to the cloud, they still don't even know what consciousness is. They have not fully defined it. No matter how many, millions, and I don't know the exact number, but copious funds are donated to the Institute of Noetic Sciences, they still haven't figured it out. And even Yuval Noah Harari himself contradicts himself, saying that we don't have consciousness, that free will is a thing of the past, it doesn't exist. But he's going to upload that thing that we don't have to the cloud because they're all afraid. And this is where, the occult belief systems tie in, because this is all about, this fear of death, this trying to cheat death, So they have to become their own gods. This is the Gnostic belief system, right? They're going to become their own gods in order to cheat death and create this, immortality. Some of them believe it's actually going to be a post-human world. Nick Land, who was very influential on Curtis Yarvin, this Dark Enlightenment movement, I will just say this, as somebody who has read a lot of philosophy, Nietzsche famously said they muddy the waters to make it seem deep. Curtis Yarvin and Nick Land don't even do that. I mean, this is some of the most garbage kind of writing. It's not even good, like, writing. It's just bad.
There was something about Curtis Yarvin, because I don't know if you know my background. I've done deep dive, like maybe a 5-part series on Dark Enlightenment, and writing.
I listened to them. They were great.
Oh, yeah. Okay, good. Yeah, that's part of the reason I wanted to have you on here, because I'm like, you're smarter with a lot of this stuff than I am. So I want to make, I was like, I wanted to kind of, vibe check and make sure I'm not going off the deep end.
But you did a fantastic job. Yeah.
Oh, thanks. And one of the things, because I don't know how to read their writings through that sort of philosophical, critical thinking of seeing where their logical fallacies are and where their arguments fall apart. But one thing that stuck out to me is Curtis Yarvin was, as part of this whole thing of tearing down the cathedral and getting rid of all of our constitutional rights, which include free speech.
Yes.
He says, well, we got to get rid of free speech. And I'm like, well, dude, like, your ideas wouldn't be allowed on the internet then. So how does that fit into your philosophy of how great this is going to be? You know what I mean? Like, so I do know what you're saying. That's the only example I could think of. But.
Well, he's going to be the CEO of the GovCorp. So you just have to follow him. It doesn't matter why his ideas are trash, because he's the king. He's the techno king. And so you have this, it is a very authoritarian. They do believe it. They want to revive the it's essentially a techno neo-feudal system where, he talks about how we should be run, but like corporations, that the CEO is going to be the monarch. So you're going to have a complete like dictatorship. And then he even says that Americans need to get over their fear of dictators, because that's really the best system. We need to have a dictatorship. When you have technology that's being programmed to control, I don't think people have any concept of how truly dystopian this could get. And then so you have, when I said you have this kind of dialectic between the Game B and the, I'll very briefly kind of give you a rundown of Game B, because it's kind of it's a long dive and it's not new. It was, I had a theory that it was seeded by the intellectual dark web as an influence operation to prepare the ground for Game B. And Andrew Cohen actually has an article on his Manifest Nirvana that pretty much says that. He didn't use the words operation influence, influence operation, sorry. He didn't use those words, that's my words. However, he pretty much says that they're, preparing the landscape. And it was back in 2011, Jim Rutt, who was the chairman of Santa Fe Institute, he had met Jordan Hall, who is doing the circuit right now. We see another, just to throw a little monkey wrench in here, and I'm working on a Substack on this. We see a lot of what I call Christianese being used as kind of an umbrella to lure people. I think it's very deceptive, but we see this, we see in Dark Enlightenment, right? Peter Thiel claims he's a Christian, and that this, kind of technocratic movement, he doesn't call it that, but, he says it's all very Christian. And I don't know how the two are commensurate at all, but that is what he says. And then so he's leading with Christianity as the umbrella, to which I don't think is Christian at all, but that's the Christianese that he's putting on top of it. Then you have like ARC, Alliance for Responsible Citizenship, which is also doing that as a way to, he says that it's a conservative a counter to the World Economic Forum. However, the funding comes like pretty much directly out of the clients of the World Economic Forum called Legatum. I have a whole video tying the financial ties there. But they're also using kind of this Christian umbrella, although a lot of it looks like more Christ consciousness, theosophy rather than true Christianity. Jordan Peterson, who's helming this, is a Jungian. Jung was a Mithraean. That is, Jung actually had dreams of like overthrowing Christianity. He had a dream that he was the Lycanthropus, I don't know, the lion head of the Mithraean religion, which is essentially like a satanic figure. And he dreamt that, you know, he would overthrow Christianity. And we see echoes of this with Jordan Peterson talking about you should become the monster and incorporate it, right? This is this very kind of Mithraean concept, Kabbalistic also, of, you know, integrating your shadow, okay, integrating the dark so you can transcend. So there we have that. And then we have this with Game B, where Jordan Hall has recently converted to Christianity. He's talking about and we see overlaps because there's the network state and Peter Thiel, who is Dark Enlightenment adjacent, right? But he's also in this Game B space. And Startup Cities Foundations, I think it's called. I'll have to look up exactly what it is, but it's being held at Prospera, which is Peter Thiel's Bitcoin cities in Honduras. And the subsidiary of that is called Vitalia, but they've changed the name. They're always changing their names. It's very important to understand. But it's called now Infinita. But when it was Vitalia, you'd open the website and it would say, "A city, come build a city where death is optional." And now it's called Infinita. And it's, you know, they have all these buzzwords like longevity, which is really kind of code for transhumanism. But he did a speech there 4 years ago talking about Game B. Network states. And now he did a much shorter one at this in Prospera, talking about network states. And then he talks about liturgy. And he's essentially saying that liturgy should build communitarianism. I'm pretty sure that's not what liturgy is about. But communitarianism is this like very technological kind of, it encompasses everything with law, technology. The network state kind of concepts, monetary systems. And so he talks about that, but he also did this show of Game B Christianity. He also did another one where he says that where they were talking about how like Ephesians 4 talks about collective cognition, which I'm pretty sure it does not. but this is all gearing us towards the noosphere concept. And in Game B, they talk about collective intelligence. So this is, again, this noosphere concept. So both of them are steering us toward, both Game B and the Dark Enlightenment, in very different ways. They're giving us, you know, one is more of a top-down authoritarian GovCorp, right? But both of them are talking about dissolutions of nation state, geographical nation states, in favor of some sort of technological system, control system. And one is advocating for centralization of the information institutions would lead to, it would be the conduit for the world brain. And back then that was the academic institutions. Today, what are the information institutions? They're the internet, technology. And Balaji Srinivasan, who wrote the book on the network state, actually says that. He doesn't talk about the world brain, but he talks about how it will decentralize at first and later be re-centralized. And so he even admits that that is the purpose, that that's the idea of this decentralization. It has to be in order for the interoperability to function. So the Game B people are more like, a lot of them are disciples of people like Barbara Marx Hubbard, who was, you know, an intellectual disciple of Teilhard de Chardin, who, you know, talks about the noosphere. And she was one of the leaders of the Center for Conscious Evolution, funded by the Rockefellers. So there's a lot of Rockefeller funding in both sides, actually, which is typically the name of the game, right? That Hegelian. Okay.
And this goes back to the where we were talking about, where I get confused, because I'm like, it seems like there's a capitalism versus communism thing, and you're kind of saying, it is kind of like, I took a course on politics in America in college, and we had this whole section about how lobbyists and industries will support both sides, both candidates, because like, they don't care who gets in. They want to make sure they get their favors repaid. Right. And it's kind of like, it sounds similar to what you're talking about.
Yeah. That's a very honest teacher. Yeah. That's right. It's about serving their interests. So I think that, you know, right now what we're seeing is a lot of these Dark Enlightenment figures are surrounding Trump, And we have kind of two camps, and I think J.D. Vance is a convergence of these two. So you've got these like, you know, Theo Bros, the neo-integralists, and J.D. Vance would fall into that category. And then you've got the tech oligarch bros, and there a lot of them are Dark Enlightenment figures. And the two of them are kind of converging, which a lot of people seem confused by that. Well, I don't understand. How is this, you know, commensurate with Christianity? And why are these two, you know, washing each other's hands, so to speak? Well, why are they playing ball with each other? And I think it's operational, because the neo-integralists are trying to eradicate the First Amendment, which explicitly says that they're, you know, that religion is separate from the state, right? There's freedom of religion. It's not freedom from religion, it's freedom of religion. So that is part of the First Amendment, and it is first for a reason. Right. So there is a group that is really trying to create a theocratic movement. And I would argue they're not all neo-integralists, but certainly Vance is. And, you know, they're all kind of coalescing around Trump. And then you've got the people who want to create this GovCorp and do away with government altogether, so that they can put their GovCorp in power, privatize everything, so that they can put these tech oligarch, you know, billionaires in power. And I think that the two philosophies work very well together. They both also share underpinnings of like things like eugenics, you know, racism, this idea that, you know, like kind of a white supremacy type of philosophy. Nick Land, Dark Enlightenment accelerationist figure, talks about how he has a whole article on hyper racism. He says we have to move beyond racism. And he's essentially advocating what Elon Musk does, which is this genetic selection for positive eugenics. Right. Okay. And that's and that's what Elon Musk is doing. And is he on 14 kids that are mostly done, you know, in test tubes?
14 we know about.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But he's very much in favor. You know, a lot of people are championing that he's a natalist and that he's pro, you know, building families and having children. However, they're not necessarily looking at the fact that he's laying the groundwork for this transhuman future, where children, it doesn't matter if children are born. He's dehumanizing the whole procreation process in favor of, and desensitizing people, I shouldn't say in favor of, but by his example in favor of, but he's desensitizing people to, you know, ectolife pods, where humans are literally, like women are no longer needed, because you can have an out-of-body womb. That's really that's what they're desensitizing people to. This Dark Enlightenment is very dark. I think that this Dark MAGA movement is a nod to the Dark Enlightenment. You know, when they talk about the Golden Age, I'm not so sure that that's not, you know, an occult reference. And I don't know how golden it's going to be for the masses. These are really their ideologies that come from thinkers like Heidegger, Hegel, you know, Julius Evola, Herman Hoppe. These are not friends of liberty. They're not friends of free will in a biblical sense of free will. They're much more, when they talk about freedom, I think it's like freedom as a collective end. So very much like in the Crowleyan kind of dilemma, do what thou wilt, you know, or Nietzschean will to power. It's as an end. It's a radical freedom that is also very collectivist. It's where we march towards this omega point, or as Hegel would say, the Geist spirals towards the world rational absolute. And that's the end. And Hegel himself says that humans can have no freedom without complete subservience to the state. The state is God. Of course, that's the, yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well,
sorry,
I feel a lot. I feel like a lot darker now than before. Okay, so I know our time is short. We got to go, but I'm going to put a link in the show notes to, because I'm going to watch this video too on your Rumble with the Hegelian left right dialect and the game B stuff. Because I feel like you're unwrapping a whole nother element of this Dark Enlightenment that I'm not even looking at right now. So Where else can our listeners get more of your work, your information? Where should we send them? What link should I put in the show notes?
So if people want to start with Game B, I would tell them I've done, I don't know how many hours on this topic, but I am going to do some written pieces. I just haven't had time to do the, you know, articles on it. I will do some write-ups, but I did a 3.5 hour. I know it's a lot. I actually had AI do a like half an hour summary of it. So for people who want just the Cliff Notes version, on Game B, and it was a presentation. So people can find that. That might be a good kind of comprehensive overview of Game B. But I, you know, and then they can back up and start with the one I did on Brett Weinstein when he did his speech to the Rescue the Republic. And he talks about how it's not a republic if we can keep it. It's a republic if we can Phoenix it. And
are you talking about, is that the dude who was like, during the pandemic was all over the Joe Rogan spheres talking about that stuff?
Yes. That's
really, that guy might be involved with us too.
Well, that guy is one on the ground floor. He was at the Stanton meetings with Jim Rudd as the resident evolutionary biologist, they were creating something called the Emancipation Party, which was very like Bernie Sanders kind of platform. So both the Game B and the Dark Enlightenment figures are very much in favor of a UBI. When you really scratch beneath the surface, that's why I say it's about flavors. So with the sensibilities, with the mommy issues or the daddy issue, but either way, they're both advocating for elitist control by technology. Elite programming technology to control you. And they all have the same kind of, you know, there's nuanced differences, but yeah. And yes, this is Brett Weinstein, who talks about Phoenixing the Republic. And anybody who's familiar with the, you know, certainly there's Operation Phoenix with CIA. There's the Tavistock Operation Phoenix. There's the Rosicrucian symbol of the Phoenix. This is where we got the slogan that they used in the CIA Operation Phoenix. We have to burn the village to build the village, right? I think this is what the Great Reset is. We have to tear it down to build back better, burn it down first. So the Phoenix definitely has a lot of kind of occult messaging and symbolism, I think. And I go through that and talk about how he was on the ground floor building this Game B concept. But yes, the Game B tends to appeal more to left kind of sensibilities. There, a lot of them are disciples of people like Barbara Marx Hubbard, the theosophical kind of vein. I would tell people to go look into that. I've done a lot of episodes on that. Then of course they can, I break down some of the philosophical concepts in my Substack articles. I don't know. It's a lot. Sorry. It's a lot to try to pack into.
Yeah, this is fascinating. Okay. Then I'm going to link to, are there any social medias you prefer to use that you want me to post for them?
Sure. I mean, I'm pretty active on Twitter, although I've been a little bit less active because it takes up so much time and it's there's so much agitprop on there. I am definitely active there. I'm active on my Substack, reachable there. And then for people who are interested in more of like the fitness, health, wellness kind of space, I do a lot of that on my Instagram. So.
Okay, great. Okay, cool. I'll post all those. Hey, this was fascinating. I can't wait. Do you know when that book is going to come out that you're writing?
Yeah. So I'm hoping this summer I'm going to.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm this month I'll still be uploading, but I'm going to take a break from recording for this next month and try and finish this book up. I'm probably just going to self-publish it. So I would say, I want to say June, but probably July is when will be more realistic.
Okay. Awesome. I look forward to it. That's great. You're an expert on these things, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk to our audience. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Fascinating stuff. I can't wait for her book to come out. So check out Courtney Taylor's podcast and her social medias. I'll put links in the show notes for couple of her Rumble videos and her Substack and her whole link tree where you can catch up with her on all the socials, you know, Twitter and Instagram and all that. But yeah, special thanks to Courtney Taylor. She's doing some great research. So Check her out for more information. Thank you for listening to the show. Till next time, stay positive.